From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The U.S. has accused Iran of being behind drone attacks that cut Saudi Arabia's oil production in half. Tehran has rejected that accusation, with a senior Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commander warning that Tehran is ready for war if that's what Washington chooses. Allegations that Iran was behind the drone attacks on Saudi oil facilities were unsubstantiated and false, according to a foreign ministry spokesperson on Sunday. For more on that and on some other things happening around the world, we speak with Mark Sloboda, international relations expert based in Moscow, from Moscow, via Skype. We spoke with him Sunday. So, Mark, I want to get to that whole Yemen thing, but there were a couple of other things we wanted to talk about first, and let's jump into that.
Yeah. So, I caught an article on Defense One. Defense One is an online outlet that is pretty much just for security wonks. Okay. And particular, of course, U.S. security wonks. And so there's a lot of pro-intervention material that goes across there. You know, it's worth watching, though, just for some of the defense insider and discussion that goes on there. There's an article that came across from Defense One in the past week. Top diplomat slams endless war, cries of campaign trail as the echo of the 1930s. And they're quoting an interview with Ambassador Jim Jeffries, who is he is now the 73-year-old special representative for Syria engagement and special envoy to the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. Mm-hmm. He previously served as U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Turkey, and Albania. Right. Okay, so he's kind of the front man, basically, for the diplomatic effort to occupy East Syria.
Right.
Sitting on all of Syria's oil fields and now trying to politically blackmail Syria. We're not leaving until you give us the regime change that we couldn't achieve by our proxy jihadis to take Damascus. Mm-hmm. So he's reacting to cries in the Democratic primary, the debates, against what are called, quote, endless wars, unquote. Right. And of course, the person who has brought this forward, such that the candidates have even talked about it, not that they've talked about it much, but to the extent they have, is of course Tulsi Gabbard. Because Tulsi Gabbard has made foreign policy, in particular opposition to the U.S. I don't like the term endless wars so much as wars of hegemony. You can call them hegemonic wars, because that more accurately describes what they are. They are endless wars for domination of at least parts of the planet. And in particular, in the past 30 years, in particular, across the entirety of the Islamic world, or the Middle East and North Africa, stretching all the way from Libya to Afghanistan.
This is something Trump used that word also, that term, and it's sort of heavily subtext with the expense of it. In other words, the endless expense of doing it. And I think that's kind of... The libertarians have used that term, I think, in the same, with the same view that basically it was a permanent drain.
Yeah, Rand Paul was. There was an interesting parallel is science fiction novel, I think a series called The Forever Wars.
Right.
That came about in the 70s and 80s. I think Heinemann. So this top U.S. diplomat is responding to Democratic presidential candidates talking about endless wars. And this is, you know, despite the fact that two of the U.S. Democratic presidential candidates are themselves military veterans.
Right.
Tulsi Gabbard.
Right.
And also Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Right.
Whom have both drawn some level of opposition. Tulsi, right. Obviously more. Tulsi Gabbard was evidently excluded from the most recent Democratic debate.
Right.
As a result, the Democrats didn't talk foreign policy at all.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, and which is really a shame, because foreign policy and you know, military policy, and for the U.S., they're intimately connected together, is the primary power and purview of the executive office and the presidency of the United States, his constitutionally granted power, made even more so because Congress has in recent decades continually officially abdicated war powers to the president and refuse to take them back, even when Trump holds the office.
Right.
So the fact that in our Democratic debates, that if Tulsi is not there, that they're not even discussing our foreign and military policy around the world is a shameful condemnation,
right,
of the discussion that is supposedly going to select the Democratic presidential candidate challenge Trump for the presidency in 2020. Of course, we all really know that it's the DNC that decides that in closed smoky rooms, as we found out during the last election. Another thing that the Democratic debates are not discussing is the rigging of the last Democratic primary,
right,
by the Clinton campaign and the DNC, and particularly Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which even the next DNC chair admitted, at least temporarily, but they're not discussing that at all, and that is another shameful condemnation of the Democratic Party.
Now, also not discussing that along that same line, that in lawsuits over that rigging, they themselves pled in their own pleading, said, well, by the way, we don't have to honor any of this stuff. We can do what we want. We can make the rules up as we go along.
We don't have to honor the results of an election,
right,
a primary election.
Right.
We can just decide who the Democratic Party candidate is.
Right.
That was the Democratic Party's justification.
Under oath.
Under oath, yeah. That was their defense.
Right.
Yeah, in brushing off lawsuits. Right. We don't even have to address
that's
it.
That's right. Our rules are meaningless, right?
Our
this whole
rules
process
are meaningless. Your vote is meaningless.
That's right.
We decide who the Democratic, who the Pepsi to challenge Coke,
right,
is.
Right.
That's, yeah. That's wow. Anyway, but at least previously, when Tulsi was in a debate, they were actually, you know, using the words endless war. Many of the candidates, obviously with the exception of Joe Biden, were speaking about that we don't want to wage endless wars.
You want to hear there's some really mealy-mouthed language in here that one of them used. This article that you're talking about, by the way, is the one from June in Defense One, right? It's in the same debate, they were referring to one of the earlier Democratic debates. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York said she would, quote is important here, make sure we do not start an unwanted, never-ending war, close quote. As if, I guess, we could start a wanted one if we wanted to, but we just don't want to start an unwanted, never-ending war with Iran.
Yes, yes.
So if you want it, it's okay, though. So go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I'm going to quote Jeffers here in an interview talking about Democratic candidates' mealy-mouthed discussion on endless wars. All of those candidates, in fact, to a degree, even more than most presidential candidates, embrace American values, such as democracy, rule of law, divided government, free press, all of these great things. But let me tell you what I've learned in 50 years of experience. All these democratic values that we have done a great deal as a country to promote and to support around the world, and that's a good thing, was a good thing, rest on a foundation. That foundation is an American-led global collective security system to fend off the predators that want to tear the system apart. I guess these predators that were trying to throw apart the U.S.-dominated system would be Saddam Hussein's Iraq, because they were attacking the U.S.-led global system, I guess. Libya, Gaddafi's Libya was a threat to the United States and to its global hegemony. Obviously, as was Serbia, that needed to be invaded and dismembered, and Kosovo turned into a NATO protectorate. And Syria, Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria, so on and so on. These are the predators, I guess, that the U.S. has engaged to. Right. And he goes on to say, I could go on literally for 20 minutes with literally scores and scores of American military operations that have undergird this global security regime, U.S.-led global hegemony, and thus undergird the American and Western and U.N. value system.
So you start pulling consider that threads. Before you go again. He could go on for 20 minutes with scores and scores of operations that undergird American and UN values.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Well, is there more admission than that at its nature? It's militaristic?
Yeah. You start pulling the threads on that by claiming that every single time we threaten to fire a Tomahawk, we are getting another Vietnam or another Iraq. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the U.S. has fired far more than one Tomahawk.
Yeah, no kidding.
In the past. Please indicate, he said, and during the interview, he said, please indicate that I'm stamping my fist on the table as I'm doing this. We're going back to the 1930s. That's the echo of what I hear in these comments, the 1930s. So this is one of the country's supposed top diplomats.
Right.
And a career foreign service officer
right.
literally pounding the table with his fist, right. demanding that America's endless wars continue.
Well, see, he had to count how many of those, he started to count how many of those military operations were going on. Of course, he had to take his shoes off to do that. And so he couldn't pound his shoe on the table, but so he pounded his fist, yeah.
This is I'm literally a little flabbergasted by this because while I don't expect American diplomats to actually have any real control of American foreign policy, to hear top American diplomats champion endless hegemonic wars across the world to protect America's global security regime. And then he talks that undergird American and Western value system, Okay, all right. Considering what America's values really are, I'm not going to challenge that. But then he says he includes the UN values system.
Yeah.
And at this point, I have to be like, Mr. Jeffries, have you ever even read the UN Charter?
Yeah, right.
You do know that non-interference is, and the right of sovereignty are the principal bedrocks.
Undergirding. He's talking about undergirding.
Undergirding the actual UN Charter and international law. I mean, post-UN a rules-based order the U.S. keeps referring to and that you're obviously talking about, it has absolutely nothing to do with the actual UN-based, UN Security Council and UN Charter-based world order that claim that who for aggression is the capital crime under international law, which includes, of course, all the aggressions that the U.S. has committed across the Middle East and North Africa in pursuit of hegemony in the past 30 years. And I'm just, you know, flabbergasted about this. Not only did he say this and pound the table right. while condemning Democrats for even talking critically about it, but then he dared to invoke the UN value system, in defense of his defense of endless wars.
Of American hegemony on top of it.
Wow.
We are halfway through our newscast already, and I want to make sure we get to Yemen, because that's some important stuff, too. Obviously, there's some big things going on there. You want to go through anything else?
Yeah, Samantha Power.
Oh, right, okay.
This is quickly from Samantha's. This is in an article in the American Conservative, again, the best magazine on foreign policy to read out there, by Daniel Larson, Power's Pathetic Libyan War Excuse. And this is highlighting from Samantha Power's own memoirs,
right,
where she justifies the intervention, as they call it, the aggression against Libya, which essentially destroyed that country and then went on that the repercussions of which has destabilized that whole portion of northern Africa, right?
Yeah.
Well into Mali and elsewhere.
Right, into Central Africa, yeah, right.
Powers essentially absolves herself in the administration of what happened after the bombs.
Ooh, ooh, can I read this? Can I read this?
Yeah, please.
This is
please.
Like the punchline of my life, practically. Quote,
with quotes.
We could hardly expect to have a crystal ball when it came to accurately predicting outcomes in places where the culture was not our own, closed quote.
Now, what she's talking about there, right, that of her inability to understand the culture that are not her own, is the tribal nature, the dominantly tribal nature of social relations to this day in Libya, which I don't know, every a magazine and newspaper article that was even mildly, objective about, you know, the war, the Obama administration's war against Libya when it began, noted that it was primarily a tribal country and no one quite knew what would happen when and if Gaddafi was removed. But it might lead to some chaos and intertribal warfare, right?
Even without the tribes, she seemed shocked that if you blow up a country as the air force for Al-Qaeda and allow Al-Qaeda to take over that country, that there's going to be some chaos. Maybe that. But, oh, my God, we didn't know that their culture would do that.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
So, and of course, the result of all of this is, you know, what we have in Libya today with no effective central government years after, the bombs have stopped falling, where slaves are sold, you know, openly
right.
on the streets in Benghazi,
yep.
you know, where David Cameron and Sarkozy once declared mission accomplished and,
right.
and Libya saved. And the destabilization has spread into all the nearby countries, such that Egypt has moved tanks up and sometimes across the border, and the French then had to intervene in Mali,
right.
Because of the the echoes, the tremors that spread unrest into there, and Powers is saying we couldn't have predicted the outcome because the culture is not our own.
Actually, now, I'll take that. Let me tell you something. I would predict the Mali thing separately because before they blew up Libya, they allowed and assisted France in taking over Cote d'Ivoire. That was in late 2010.
In the Ivory
so
Coast,
the French were already moving back into their colonial space at that point. And so that, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, but all of us.
We knew it, of course.
We're predicted this, right?
Yep, of course.
We all did, and somehow Samantha Power did not, because the culture is not her own. And as Larson notes, this idea that she didn't understand Libyan culture, that it was so opaque, that should actually be an argument for not intervening at all.
Right. No kidding, okay? We don't know what we're doing.
If you don't understand the culture, then what are you doing?
Here's
overthrowing
the scale,
their government.
Here's the scale of intervention. So I think it was June 10th of 2011. Cynthia McKinney was on the ground in Tripoli with observers from the African Union. And I interviewed her over the phone, and she described for me the previous day where for 12 hours in the city of 2 million people, it's about the same population as Manhattan, not New York City, just Manhattan, 2 million people, they counted 83 bombs dropped on the city in a 12-hour period. They would bomb for 12 hours and rest for 12 hours. And this is in one city. You know, this is, they hear what goes on in Tripoli, not mentioning what goes on in certain, you know, the other cities around the country. So, and they did that from March 20th until October 20th in 2011. So, you know, New York City, two explosions on September 11th, 2001, and all hell breaks loose. Still 20 years later, here we are. Okay, this place, in one day, 83 explosions, you know, and something the size of Manhattan, but without Brooklyn across the water from it. And that happens every day for 7 months, or 210 days in a row. And they expect there's not going to be some kind of response in the aftermath. I just don't get it, no matter whose culture it is.
And the result is the constant warfare in Libya today that's going on. Yep. A country that once had the highest human development index in Africa. Yep. An intervention which the African Union was adamantly opposed to. And right. You can't get the African Union to agree on anything ever. And it resulted also in, of course, the near complete destruction of the great man-made river.
That's right.
This amazing engineering construct of Gaddafi's government there, that created this network of pipes that supplies water, you know, to the desert, the portions of the Sahara in right. Libya, and also, you know, helped provide water to other surrounding
That's
countries.
Right. Yep.
Right. You know, the real horrible thing that we're faced with, that with part of the bombing of this, that it may have been a deliberate policy, of course, to
That's
destroy
right. That's right.
this thing that, you know, brought life to the desert.
Right.
And that's, you know, something, you know, that is too much to bear. And Samantha Power's excuses make the Obama administration's destruction of Libya all the more painful and embarrassing.
You know, look, at the time, Gaddafi and Libya were assisting, you know, looking basically at African unity as the primary project that was necessary for the future of Africa. And they had the money to fund it, and they were funding projects.
Yes.
And so in order to put that off, the U.S. wanted to have instead AFRICOM deployed across Africa and continue colonial relations. Well, what had to happen was for Libya to be destroyed so that it could never, you know, with a change of administration, become a threat again. And so that's what was done as a conscious policy. It's obvious. And it happened at the same time that the French came in and recolonized Northern Africa with U.S. assistance. I mean, it was clear this was the policy of the Obama administration to retake Africa.
Yeah, and the U.S. has military operations in 53 African nations today.
And it was 35 that's last Africa. I know, but damn.
And now, you know, I mean, the very fact that the U.S. has a military headquarters for Africa
right.
tells you about the colonial nature of the U.S. Military presence.
Yep.
I see another challenging that, saying that the U.S. only has a military presence in 50 out of 54 African countries today.
Right. All right, we better go to Yemen because we're pretty close to out of time already. And we've got 5 minutes left.
Okay, so the big news that hit Yemen, we've talked previously briefly about the Saudis' war not going well with first Qatar and now the United Arab Emirates pulling out of the Saudi war effort, where Saudi dictatorship, the third biggest military spender in the world, is invading, militarily occupying and conducting a genocidal starvation campaign against the poorest country in the world, Yemen. Basically because they're afraid of political results in Yemen, particularly with the domination of the country by the former student religious movement, the Houthis, having a demonstrative effect into the Shia minority in Saudi Arabia, which of course is located right across the border, the whole tribal connection thing across these arbitrarily modern state-drawn lines, and that of course being where no significant part of Saudi's oil reserves are. And that war is not going well, and the UAE has pulled out and actually started supporting the southern separatists, as they call them, and we're faced that in any way, when Saudi does pull out, they'll probably be left with nothing, and that both South and North Yemen will go in their own way, as was the case during the Cold War. To drive all of this home and the desperation that Saudi is facing, the U.S. has been trying to conduct talks with the Houthis on behalf of the Saudis in Oman, which was kind of a signal that Saudi Arabia is ready to throw in the towel. And now we have a drone attack on some Aramco, two different Aramco, that's the Arab American Oil Company, which is Saudi Arabia's national oil company.
Pretty much one of the largest oil
companies. The economy of Saudi Arabia. Right. So they've hit these with a drone attack, 10 drones. Anything very sophisticated, but they've caused fires which have forced the Saudis to shut down a significant a part of their infrastructure and facilities, which has led to the halt of 5 million barrels of oil a day.
Or 5% of the global. That's 5% of the global.
Yeah. Half of the kingdom's output, half of Saudi Arabia's output, and 5% of global oil supply. Yep. And, of course, the U.S. is absolutely outraged at this. How dare the Houthis strike back in a way that threatens our allied dictatorship's oil flow to the world? I mean, this is inevitable blowback. If Saudi Arabia goes to war and that country is able to strike back, of course they're going to strike back at Saudi Arabia's oil supply.
No kidding.
There's a post facto attempt to try to blame this on Iran now, being spread by Mike Pompeo. And his argument is there is no evidence the Iranians aren't involved. And obviously he doesn't understand this whole burden of proof. Well, actually, the truth is the whole burden of proof thing doesn't apply to the U.S. government. Without any proof that the Iranians were involved, they're simply able to blame Iran for all of this. But it's not going to take away that Saudi Arabia, with all of that military spending, all of that arms purchase from the U.S., U.K., France, Germany, and everyone else,
everybody
is still being beaten by the desert tribes of the poorest country in the world. And now they've brought this deep into Saudi Arabia, hitting at the vital oil infrastructure. The air defenses there just can't even detect drones. They're completely unprepared for this type of modern warfare. They can't protect the pipelines there. Even if the U.S. went in and militarized the entire length of the pipelines, they wouldn't be able to protect the whole infrastructure there. This is what Saudi Arabia is going to be facing. There's even the possibility that these drones were actually launched from within Saudi Arabia.
That's
and the Houthis, in their statement claiming credit for it, talked about the cooperation of the honest people of Saudi Arabia. Okay. And of course, he's talking about the Shia tribal minority there. And that's got to make Saudi Arabia even more
nervous. And we'll have to come back to that next week. Yeah. We're out of time, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.